Welcome everyone to Big Society Part 2. Great pleasure to welcome on behalf of you all a very distinguished panel here who I know will guide us through a very interesting time. I'm Jackie Christian. I'm going to host and hopefully facilitate this effectively for you. So let me just introduce very briefly the panelists to you, because I'm working on the assumption that you're here because you're interested in what they might have to say and therefore know a little about them anyway. This is Ed Cox. He is the director of IPPR North and is also a chair of a community and church project in Manchester. Richard Wilkinson is academic and author and has just been talking about his book, The Spirit Level, which I expect some of you will have been to. And Morrissey also is a publisher of books, a community theologian and lecturer. And Morris, too, is pursuing an academic career and has just been in here talking to us about Citizens UK. So each of them bring a perspective which will enhance very much our conversation this evening about the big society. There's going to be opportunities for you to participate, opportunities for you to talk to one another. And of course, we will be hearing from the panel. I'm very conscious that there's still a lot of people who are trying to come in. So perhaps if you're at the front or you can do a bit of scooching up, it will mean that the people who, there's always people who want to slope in at the last minute, isn't there? So let's give them a chance. Let's be community and friendly. Yes, inclusive, welcoming. Very good. So, Big Society, the title of our session this evening is there such a thing as the Big Society? And I'm just going to invite you all in the audience to give a show of hands if you support this notion. Is there such a thing as a Big Society? So if you think, yes, there is, can you put your hands up? Okay. Okay, that's yes. If you think there isn't such a thing as the Big Society, put your hands up. What would you say? Yeah, okay, and put your hands up if you really don't know, because clearly there's some don't-knowers. Okay, so we're pretty evenly split on all of that sort of thing. On Friday night, Bishop Tim was talking about the fact that many people see the Big Society as an excuse to hide behind public sector cuts, but he urged us to also see it as an opportunity for people of faith to engage and to take the opportunity to be doing what we have been doing, in fact, for 2,000 years. So my next question, just to sort of again gauge with where you're at, is would you mind putting up your hand if, in fact, you do think that the Big Society is actually just an excuse, rhetoric, or a means of hiding public sector cuts? Ah, okay. Worth asking the question, very revealing. That we do have consensus on that. Put your hand up also then if you do see it as an opportunity for the churches to participate and to be able to show the work which many of us are already involved in transforming our local communities. Good. So we're cynics and we're optimists as well. So I thought that would just give our panel here an opportunity to see where we're at. And perhaps we'll ask the question at the end and see if we feel any differently about what the Big Society is. Thank you for your participation so far. And Anne has very kindly offered to kick off.
Thank you. It was very reassuring to see that kind of range of views. I've decided that the term I want to use to describe the Big Society is the least dirty shirt when you've run out of clean ones, which I think is better than using the description the curate egg, good and bad in parts. It's an effort, and it's passable. I have a problem with the word big, and there have been a number of sessions that I have been party to which has helped clarify for me why I don't like the idea big. And it's partly because place matters and precision matters. So part of the dirty stain on the shirt that's least dirty in the laundry bag is that it talks about big. And there is, for me, a risk about the emphasis on big, because for anything to be big, it has to have a big story to motivate it, to sustain it. And I think in anxious times, we are wise to be suspicious of any big story, because our history and our European history is littered by the ease with which people can give a fraudulent big story that can energize a big society. Let me give some very simple illustrations of, I suppose, Edmund Burke has got there before us with the idea of little platoons. And I racked my brain to try and get a more politically acceptable term for platoon. I couldn't, because the essence of a platoon is purposefulness and a commitment to actually achieve the task. And I think that has to be a non-negotiable aspect of the clean part of the shirt that's called big society. But it will be about little actions. But I illustrate a little action and we see its potency. Grandmothers on housing schemes in Scotland. They say through experience, personal experience, methadone is nay answer. Well, what do we do? Well, singing gives the motivation to rise above circumstances. So another gran would say, well, let's open the church hall and we'll do some singing. And another gran says, ah, they'd nay come. They'd nay be able to get themselves together to come. And another gran says, well, we'll go to their wee flats and we'll sing with them there. And another gran says, do you know what? We should do that and we'll make sure we'll take some hot food with us because their gas and electricity will be switched off. Now, that's the kind of precision that little platoons can make. My final comment is that in political terms, the government may be more successful at rolling back the state. But if big society, in its best aspect, is to be a possibility, we also have to find a way of rolling back the market. And that's neither being offered as a possibility, nor do I think we quite know how to do that. I leave you with a question. And the question is, to what extent can we say that Greenbelt is an exceptional and desirable manifestation of the big society?
Thank you, Anne. Before we go to Ed, I'm just very conscious there's a lot of people standing at the door, so there's plenty of space here. Can we just give people a chance to just scooch, come in? And if you can scooch up, which is a technical term for making space, then that's very kind. So anyone who's wanting to come in, now's a come-in, good come-in moment. And you haven't missed much. Well, you've missed Anne, which was very good. Oh, okay. I'm going to take that back. I've still had far more humiliating experiences in terms of what I've said at Greenbelt, believe me, which I will not be sharing with you. What I mean is we're at the beginning. You have clearly missed Anne's presentation, which was worth listening to it, but there is plenty more to come. So, oh dear, have I got away with that one now? Right, before I say anything else terrible, I'm going to hand over to Ed. Thank you.
Thanks, Jackie. I want to talk about Big Society as a brand, and I want to talk about Big Society as a set of policies, which is where IPPR North, my organisation, is coming from, is how does it work as a set of policies? But I want to start by saying that I think Big Society is really important, and I think we need to engage with it as a very simple concept around neighbourliness and around community action. And if we just take it at a very basic level, as a call by government for us all to be more neighbourly, for us all to be more active in our communities, then and we just leave it there as a simple concept without politicising it too far, then I think it's something that we should get behind, and it's something which is very important, and it's obviously something that's been going on for a very long time. My experience working in inner city Manchester is one that despite all the stuff that commentators say about a big society, if you talk to people about their desire for relationship, Maurice was talking about that a little bit earlier, if you talk to people about their desire to get involved in something in their community and put the label big society with it, people do respond very positively. And even though it might be that it's very easy for us as commentators, as policy wonks, to pour cold water over the concept, we mustn't lose, I think, something that the Conservative Party have clearly picked up, which is a genuine desire that people do have to do something good in their neighbourhood. And all my experience working with the Inspire Centre, something we've set up in Manchester, transformed a church building into a place which is open 7 days a week for people to get involved, is people have come and said, we want to get involved. We can't. There's so many people who have come through the doors and wanted to be part of what you might want to call big society. But let me touch on it as a brand, because I think actually it's been incredibly successful as a brand. Okay, it might have got a bit toxic more recently, but I worked for Hazel Blears when she was Secretary of State for Communities and Local Government, and during that time we let 1,000 flowers bloom in terms of communities' policies of different kinds. And Hazel would often say, I do wish government could just get a bit of the credit for the millions of different programmes that we have initiated. Well, whether she was right or wrong about that, one of the conversations that we had within the department is there an overarching brand that we could put together that all the different government communities, policies and programmes could sit within so that government would actually get a bit more recognition and credibility for what it was trying to do? And we failed completely to come up with something on that count. And I feel that the Conservatives have come up with something which is incredibly powerful. Mori did a survey which suggests that they have 42% brand recognition with the term big society. Now, as government programmes go, that is completely fantastic. And I think also the very fact that there's so many people in this tent today suggests that they've generated a debate both on the left and the right. We can get into what that debate looks like from the left and the right perhaps later on. But they've generated a debate which I think is very healthy and very positive. So in that sense, the brand has been important. However, as with any brand, you've got to ask the question, what is beneath the surface? And so where I want to now go is just to talk about some of the policies. And to ask the question, to what extent is a big society a fair society? Because for IPPR, that is the central question that we think needs to be answered. And it's got a very simple answer. We believe that a big society is not going to be a more fair society. Firstly, different groups, different community organisations, faith organisations have quite different levels of dependency, or what I would prefer to call interdependency, to be positive about it, between the state and the activity that they do. Research that we have done shows that in the northeast and the northwest, 43% of community and voluntary organisations are dependent upon state funding in some way, shape or form, whereas in London, only 33% are. So if we're seeing this in a time of cuts, then suddenly that interdependency has a much bigger impact in the north than it would necessarily in the south. If we're to take the government at its word, and that this is actually about philanthropy and not about state dependency, you have the same pattern emerging. In 2009-10, in the northeast, there were just 6 donations to charity of £1 million. In London, there were 40 donations. So there's obviously another, discrepancy there, which means that places in the north or groups in the north might suffer more than those in the south. And if you think about how easy it might be for community groups to move into social enterprise, something, again, we've done a lot of research about, what we're finding is that in deprived communities, the leap that community groups have to make in order to become more enterprising is so much greater, largely because the market has actually left that space, because there aren't any enterprising profits or whatever you might want, surpluses to be found in those neighbourhoods. So we believe that deprived neighbourhoods will suffer under big society policies and programmes. And finally, a lot of it, in terms of the way in which big society programmes are going to be implemented, is through processes of commissioning and tendering and these new products that the Big Society Bank is going to produce, these new financial products, which are all aimed at the bigger organisations. So we believe that the smaller organisations are going to suffer, and they're the ones most likely to go out of business, so to speak, first of all. So our analysis would suggest that although big society is a very simple concept of neighbourliness and community action, is something very positive and we should seize the opportunity, it is much more, it's very, very likely that it's actually going to be the sharp-elbowed middle classes that actually do best out of the policies and programmes, and the bigger charities and bigger organisations, and as a result we'll be left with a much less fair society.
Thank you very much.
So my question is, do you agree with me that a big society is going to be a less fair society?
Well, as he's asked that so directly, you can we could do a quick straw poll on that. Do you agree that? Okay, right, good. Okay, he wants to know, does anyone not agree? Don't worry, he's not going to come after you individually at the end. No, interesting. I think that also leads very well into Richard's perspective. Richard, thank you.
Yes, I look at things to do with the big society in total isolation, sitting in front of a computer, working at home, never talking to anyone else, never part of any community, but seeing it all in terms of data and figures. There's no doubt at all. And I take the big society as meaning a society which is more cohesive, where community life is stronger, where people take care of each other more. Those societies exist. Some societies have much stronger community life. People trust each other more. There's less violence. Some societies are much more cohesive than others. And what seems to determine that in a very powerful way is the level of inequality between us. People have always known that inequality was divisive and socially corrosive. The material differences between us create the social differences. They drive the social differences. You know, if you look at the data, countries like the Nordic countries and Japan, the more equal ones, perhaps 60 or 65% of the population feel that in general you can trust others. In the more unequal societies, it drops to 20 or 15%. Huge differences. We find exactly that pattern repeated amongst the American states. The more equal American states, with the smaller income differences, people feel that stronger sense of trust. Social capital is higher. Measures of social cohesion are higher. In some studies, you find violence is 10 times as high, measured by things like homicide rates in more unequal societies. So I think it's inescapable that the most powerful way of creating a society which is more cohesive, in which people do take more care of each other, is by reducing the income differences. I sometimes think about the sort of political philosophy of Hobbes. You know, Hobbes says, and it's particularly relevant, I think, after the riots, that because we all have the same needs, if you don't have a government with overriding power to keep the peace through police and so on, life would be nasty, brutish, and short. The competition of each against all would mean we were all fighting over everything. That was his vision. You need a government to keep the peace. But in fact, what he didn't realize about societies before government is, although there was that potential for conflict over everything, how they actually kept the peace, as many anthropologists, and I'm thinking particularly of Marshall Sahlins, have shown, is through gift exchange, food sharing, things like that. Small-scale hunting and gathering societies in which we existed for 90% of our time as anatomically modern human beings with brains the size they are now and so on. Most of our history has been as pretty egalitarian animals. You know, we did not live in societies where the poor only got food and the weak only got food if there was some left after the strong had had their fill, or where dominant males monopolized access to females. What Hobbes didn't realize is that we not only have the potential to fight each other over everything, but we have the potential to be the greatest source of cooperation, assistance, friendship, love, learning, empathy, so on. You know, if a bird breaks a wing or a leg, there's not much another one could do for it. But we'll get taken care of by each other. Human life has depended on that kind of cooperation. And so always the opposite possibility to the conflict between us, and I think in our societies that comes out in status competition, driving consumerism and so on, is greater equality, improving the quality of social relations, as the data, international data, makes absolutely clear. It's interesting, you can actually see, and of course after the riots, it's, you know, when people talk about more policing and so on, what we all want is a society that needs very little policing. And again, there are papers, research papers in the United States that show inequality. You put more people in prison. You need more police. You need more defense against other people. Great inequality needs that kind of defense. We need to defend ourselves against each other. But how you get rid of that, how you create really a more cohesive society in which we do care for each other, in which we do feel in the same boat as each other, is greater equality. I think that's probably all I had to say. I get another chance to come back later, I think, so I'll stop. Well, I've spent 35 years working on the effects of inequality, and if I'd been able to tell you a bit more and show you more of the data, I would have asked you, you know, what can we as individuals do about the scale of inequality? Inequality in our society has got back to the levels it was in the 1920s. And that's what's happened to social cohesion, has been really damaged by that. What we've seen in our society since the huge rise in inequality in the 1980s are that we've become a more antisocial society in all sorts of ways. So we must think what we can do to reverse that process.
Thank you, Richard. Yeah, Maurice, thank you for your contribution.
Yeah, good evening, everybody. And just to say how much I appreciated each of those. But I think that the situation is a bit more extreme and a bit more severe. So just to say, I think I'm with a lot of people in, I'd like there to be a big society, but I don't think that there is one, is roughly what I would say. And I would say that that's due to very deep and fundamental historical events. And just to summarise roughly, you could call them the market and the state. So roughly speaking, we had this market that essentially individuated us, that commodified us, and then we, roughly speaking, turned to the state to protect us. And in the process of that, society, what is society? I think that Richard used beautiful language in relation to that. It's relationships, friendships, solidarity. The way that I would like to talk about it is that we've had actually quite a lot of redistribution, and we've had an enormous amount of contract. What do we have? You know, we've got a massive, great market. We've got a pretty big state, and we've got a quite measly society, I would say, is where the balance of the relationship goes in all of that. And the key concept missing, so we've got contract, which is market relations, and we've got redistribution to some extent, but we've lost reciprocity. We've lost relational reciprocity, which is the way that people are friends to each other, are neighbours to each other, or colleagues to each other, or citizens. I mean, that sounds a bit outlandish, I guess, but that's another very important concept that we've got to put in. And I just want to complicate Richard's view a bit and add a rider. I mean, if you look at Japan and the Nordic countries, the overwhelming feature of those societies is both ethnic and religious homogeneity is far more prevalent in those societies than in ours. So we're in a situation where we've got to develop a politics of a common good under quite extreme conditions of radical pluralism, under very intense conditions of financial domination, and under conditions where the story that Anne talks about, the 1945 Social Democrat Labour story, has broken down. And one of the reasons it's broken down is because state bureaucrats were so horrible to the people that they served. If you go down Tottenham High Street, the places that are really burnt down are the youth centre, the unemployment. It's an incredible act of rage against public sector and local authority institutions. And that hasn't really been picked up. So if we're going to talk about an agenda in which reciprocity, relationships and responsibility are central, and if we're going to, I think we have to begin thinking also not just about what individuals can do to make a difference, but what institutions and groups can do to make a difference, and particularly what churches can do as public institutions to generate a culture that is much more based on vocation, on virtue, and on value. I think those are also very important ideas. So in terms of this, of what Ed and Richard were talking about fairness and about equality, I would like to say that there's that we've got to look at it in three ways. And looking at it on three ways is not just a way that I'm trying to appeal to a Christian audience. I think there's virtues in it independently of that, but there's a slight element of manipulation involved, I think. And the key thing with the three is we've got to talk about material inequality, but I would disagree with Richard in saying that that is the driver and the motor, because there's also power inequality. If you're talking about the missing links in the big society, is who can stand up to the banks, who can stand up to a boss, who can stand up to financial power. There's no agenda for, Anne, you mentioned it very well. So can we talk about a sense of vocation in which there's genuine vocational training, where the market doesn't determine who is and who is not a plumber, but some vocational qualification determines that? Could we start talking about a common good within the firm, like there is in Germany, where there's worker representation on the governance of the firm? Can we talk about regional banks, where banks can only lend within certain counties? This is the concept of place that you talked about, where it's not just all going to the City of London and then getting lost in international speculation. So we have to think, I think, about a politics of a common good in which material inequality takes its place with power inequality and then with relational inequality. Because what we do know, and the overwhelming data shows us, is that if you have more contact growing up with a loving adult, your life goes better. Well, who would have thought, eh? I mean, it's but if you've got to work for and you've got to take two jobs and you can't spend time with your children, who would have thought that older people who are in a more vulnerable state prefer to be cared for by people that love them? These are the issues we've got to look at it. So power inequality, which is institutional inequality, which is deeply rooted in both a Fabian kind of socialism that likes to do equality to people, and in a capitalism in which managerial sovereignty cannot be questioned for fear of, a banking collapse, for example. So you've got an authoritarian system at work, you've got an authoritarian system in the state. There is no, all forms of societal relations are undermined by that. So the big society is, in the worst sense of the term, an aspiration, because while its critique of the state is not bad in many ways, it's the total absence of any conceptualization of market power. That, David Cameron came to London Citizens and said the living wage is an idea whose time has come. Well, we're still waiting. This is a year, and it hasn't happened. It hasn't happened at all. So just to say that I think when we look at the concept of equality, we've got to be thinking much more about these things: reciprocity, relationships, and responsibility, about a genuine culture of give and take, where there is institutional power for workers. So to give you one straight example, how would I reform public sector? How would I reform the private sector? Once again, I'd work in thirds. A third representation for either the state, the funders, the state or the owners, a third representation for the workforce, and a third representation for users, and then take it from there. But what we haven't thought through is how to challenge managerial domination through the representation of interest, so that there is greater relational equality and that there is also greater power equality, which can then serve as the underpinning for generating the consensus for a greater material equality, because people on the whole want to be treated as human beings, and you cannot do it on your own. That has to be done through working with others and through association. So I guess my question to you, which is not completely connected, but I'm just genuinely interested to know, is do you have any friends on your street? There you go. That's my question. Thank you.
that looks like a show of hands questions to me. Do you have friends on your street? Oh, what a friendly bunch of people. Very good. Thank you very much on behalf of everyone here for the different perspectives that we've heard on the Big Society. I'm not going to recap for you because I'm conscious that time is of the essence in a session like this. But what I am going to do is to invite you to have the opportunity to discuss with a neighbour, a partner near to you. If Morrison was doing this, he would insist that it was someone that you didn't know, wouldn't you? As a one-to-one, as someone that you didn't know, and to reflect on what you've just heard and specifically the questions that have been asked. I'm going to remind you what they are in just a minute. Okay. I'm then going to give you the opportunity to have a chat amongst yourself. We're going to have a chat up here amongst ourselves, and then I'm going to invite comment from the floor. So in the first instance, it's going to be comment, and we're going to try and establish how much consensus there is around the ideas and the thoughts which are coming out from the conversation. And then I will open it up to questions which you can put directly to the panel and give them an opportunity to converse with one another. But first, I'm just going to give you the opportunity to talk one-on-one and to remind you what those questions were. To what extent is the big society be a more fair society? To what extent is Greenbelt an exceptional expression or manifestation of the big society? What can people do about the scale of inequality in our society? And we've answered about, do you have any friends in your street? But perhaps there's an opportunity to talk a little bit more about the relationships which you have in your community. You can pick which questions you want to answer. You can talk about whatever you like. This is your opportunity to have a little conversation. We'll bring it back for comment. We'll bring it back for questions.
Whereas it's actually the situation that you've got extreme poverty right next to extreme wealth, and that divide seems to be more at the root of it. And so it was just an agreement, and I'm really enjoying myself.
You've mentioned the point agreement, and that reminded me. We were, after the discussion on Friday, we were talking about whether we'd be really daring and experimental in this session and invite you, and bear with me, I'm going to try and articulate this well. If someone's making a comment or a point that you're agreeing with, yeah, is to be able to... Do you want to demonstrate for us? Give the little hand signal, okay? So it's just to, it gives other people in the room a chance to sort of gauge where things are going, gives the panel an opportunity to see whether there's a consensus around this. So if you hear something and it's reflective of what you've been discussing, give us the little wave. Okay, I've got a question here.
Hopefully a quick question. My name's Andy. a comment. Oh, it can be a comment. What on earth's going on that all of our language is being mediated by a speech David Cameron made or the policy unit? We're all talking about the big society. I mean, the church, we have our own language, we have our own traditions and so forth, but all of our conversation is being mediated. It's all over Greenbelt. It's all being mediated by this thing called the big society. I mean, someone's got power over us and something's happening to us and our traditions, and it's not being run by us. Someone else is doing something to us.
Yeah, question there.
Alex, I live in London. Got a question for Morris, really. He asked the question, how many people know people on their street and are they friends with them? I live in London. I don't know anybody on my street. I know three friends who live three streets away. I don't know if that counts. But they don't know each other, though, on the street. That's an interesting point in itself. And I attend a church in the centre of town, and we've recently got some information back on postcodes, and the attendees of the church come from far and wide. Some of them don't actually live in Greater London itself and live further afield than that. Is that a failure? Does that class as big society, or is that not allowed because it's not a society of location but a society of interest?
Thank you.
Arkell Bell, the examples we talked about, I suppose, were the opposite of big society. All the good examples we could think of were that small projects were good projects. And maybe we need to go back to Schumacher in the 70s, that small is beautiful.
Getting a lot of approval on the small is beautiful. Thank you for keeping your comment brief. We've got a comment over here. Yep. Then I'm heading this way.
It's really about the insidiousness of the market. And how one of you, the guy in the blue shirt. Ed, sorry. You used the language of the market, you know, to talk about brands, products, and so on. And to me, that's one of the problems that's been happening, is that the, for example, we were talking about local authorities aping, in effect, the companies and the market. And, you know, I kind of shudder whenever I hear a thing described as a brand or a product, because actually, you know, which came first, from where I'm sitting, Christianity or brands? God or brands?
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Jackie, and I come from the northeast of England, an area of high deprivation, and run a small community organisation there. And I really resonated with a lot of what you said. And as a liberation psychologist, I'd just like to make a plug here for hope. The one thing that I feel like I have lacked at times is hope. And it's only actually sheer grit, determination, and a willingness to keep hope that that keeps me going. I made myself redundant at the end of last month because our funding has been reduced. And I've gone back to our organisation as a volunteer, and I'm now working full-time for free. And on Tuesday, we won £45,000 worth of funding. So, hope.
Can I just do a quick hand raising? How many people out of interest work in the public sector in this room? Okay. Well, in the broadest sense. Voluntary sector? How many people volunteer in the voluntary sector? Yeah, okay. Participants. We've got a comment down here. Can you just do a bit of indicating if you've got comments that you want to make? And we've got one here, and I'll come back down to here. Okay.
My name's Pat, and my comment is about inequality. I spent 3 years working in North Lambeth with churches there, where there's a big problem of gun and gang crime, youth disaffection, next door to areas of extreme wealth, as we're within the division bell. You've got MPs, you've got lords living alongside these people on this estate. When we hold meetings about what we want to do, it's the wealthy who turn up. They want to do something. They want to engage. It's not the kids off the estate to come. But we're able, when the library is going to close, to get a campaign to stop it closing. We're able to do a lot of things in that area. Now, and for the next 3 years, I'm working in Stoke-on-Trent. There's not a lot of inequality in Stoke-on-Trent, because if you've got any money, you don't live in Stoke-on-Trent. You have got families of three or four generations living on the same street. You have got a great sense of society, of people looking after each other. But what you haven't got are the advocates to stop the library closing, to stop the Sure Start closing, to stop the youth workers being made unemployed. You haven't got that sense of ability to do something about what's going on. You just have to sit there and take it and get on with it. So, yes, you can get rid of inequality in an area by going down to the lowest level, but that doesn't actually solve the problem, because you haven't got the people there to actually fight for you in an effective way.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm going to take a comment here.
I'm David Campanale. I'm from West London in Kingston. Last year, just before the general election, and perhaps no coincidence, David Cameron, together with the local Liberal Democrat MPs, turned up at the hospital to say, Kingston Hospital is safe in our hands. We're absolutely committed to the future of this public institution. This week's local newspaper, the Surrey Comet, the front page was, waiting lists at Kingston Hospital are the longest in the country and have gone up dramatically. Hundreds of jobs are going to be lost at the hospital. I'd love everything that's been said from the panel. The point I want to make is that there is a deep loss of trust in public institutions because of a deep lack of trust in the political preferences of the big three parties that we've got, who all ape the language of the market, who all are sold out to the interests of the commercial businesses. They love the state, because the state provides them with the biggest contracts and the biggest profits. I'm inspired by the Christian Democratic model in Europe. I'm a Christian Democrat and I'm chairman of the Christian People's Alliance. And I'm inspired by the social insurance models of Christian Democrats launched after, in many instances, after the Second World War. And I would just love to see that, what they've produced is an alternative means of delivering welfare to the state. And I just wonder whether in Britain, whether we can have some of these organisations owned by the working people, paid for by working people. And I'd just love to hear from the panellists whether they see that as a way forward in Britain.
We're going to do one question there, one comment there, and then we're going to come back up to the panel, and then we'll take it back out for questions. So let's... And don't worry, I'm not going to expect you to remember all these questions and answers. We'll just take some comments on them. So let's go there first.
Yeah, yep. My name's Michael Dyer. I'm from Aberdeen. I want to put in a shout for the state because against localism. The problem with localism is that the poor end up sharing their poverty and the rich share their riches. And if there's going to be any redistribution and greater economic equality, then the state is needed to make sure those redistributions take place. That's an old social democratic point, and I'm proud to support it.
I'm Tricia. I live in the Forest of Dean in Gloucestershire. We've watched statutory services over the last few years cut dramatically. There's been a much greater reliance on voluntary organisations. Now we're finding with current cuts that the voluntary organisations are getting funding stopped as well. We have actually quite a strong population who will defend themselves quite well over a variety of issues. But I do think that we have got social care concerns. And one of the things that bothers me when they talk about the big society is just how far can you stretch goodwill within any community?
Thank you very much for all your comments and contributions from the floor. We're going to come back to you, but I'm going to go up to the panel now. And I'm going to pick on Ed. Tell us your thoughts on what you've heard from the floor. I'm not going to ask you to synthesise it, but just pick out some of the things which resonated particularly with you.
Okay, four quick thoughts. Firstly, the issue that somebody raised about communities of interest. I think that's a really, really important issue. And a lot of government policy at the moment is around neighbourhoods. I haven't got anything against neighbourhoods. And around geography and place. And all of those are really important things. But I do think there is a huge amount to be said for organising across interest. And I think it's particularly true in terms of the equalities streams, which I think are getting lost in the discussion about big society. And we need, in our churches as faith organisations, I think need to be advocating for government to make sure that its policies don't just focus on place, but also work with some of the intermediary organisations that work across place with communities of interest. A quick comment on inequality. At IPPR North, we tried to replicate some of the research that Richard and Kate Pickett had done in the spirit level, and it's produced in a report which you can read called Richer Yet Poorer. We tried to see whether the levels of inequality that are growing in the UK are having similar effects to those that are demonstrated internationally in the US in the spirit level book. And what we found was that we couldn't demonstrate the fact that growing inequality had a whole range of other spin-offs in relation to other outcomes to do with health and crime and all the things that Richard and Kate do. But what we could do, in fact, the only area where we could show that there was a correlation between growing inequality and everybody being affected, rich and poor being affected, is in their sense of efficacy and in their sense of cohesion. So we couldn't show that it mapped against health outcomes or crime outcomes and so on, but we could show that growing inequality between northern cities in Britain and between the regions in Britain, between north and south in Britain, was causing us to feel less able to influence things. So there's a little addition to the inequality discussion. On the brand, just simply to say, I wasn't advocating Big Society as a brand. I was simply saying it is a brand and we have to deal with it as a brand, both positively and negatively. And I think that leads to the question and where I want to finish, which is around why are we having this conversation about Big Society? Why is it such a pervasive brand. And I think a lot of it is to do with the fact that we live in a highly centralised state. And I think a lot of our discussion that we're having this evening has been very crude about the state. We've just called the state the state. We haven't actually got into what we mean by the state. And there are two reflections that I want to share on that. Firstly, and many of you here, I think, will probably exemplify this, are brilliant public servants. And the constant ranting that we're having against the state, smaller state and so on, and it happens both right and left, Morris, I ought to say, is actually really unhelpful for those people that are trying to build relationships as public servants in doing their jobs. And I think it's very important that we need to hold on to that and not criticise the state willy-nilly. The other thing, though, and I think this is critical to some of the conversations we've been having about brand and about why we jump around on the notion of big society, is the fact that we have a hugely centralised state. The problem isn't necessarily with the state per se, it's that so much of our conversation about the state has to take place through the channels of Whitehall and Westminster. And my sense is that actually what we need is a far more empowered, far more active, far more democratic local state. And if we transfer far more power and finance from the national to the local, then it will enable us to feel more empowered, both as community groups and as local government and other public service providers, to provide the services in a more equal way. So my sense is that actually we shouldn't be against the state carte blanche, but we need a much more localised state than we've got at the moment.
Thank you. Anne, you're looking poised with the microphone. Are you wanting to come in at this point? And Richard, yeah, let's do Anne and then come.
I think one of the things that would be deeply costly would be the loss
Anne,
of hope.
Sorry, can you just keep it close?
The loss of hope, and also allowing the language that we are, if you want, feeling acting upon us, allowing that to contaminate our imagination and hence limit the actions that we can see as being possible. I want to make the comment that we know something about this species, Homo sapien. And one of the things we know is that hope, a bit like wealth, doesn't trickle down. It always springs up. And I think there's something there about a network society as well as a placed society. Both can achieve a momentum which I now describe as enacted hope, because one of the dangers we have as people of faith is to use the cliche of hope too frequently, and to just proclaim hope is actually an insult in the troubled days in which we exist. The other thing that we know about being the species Homo sapien is that our most dastardly acts, whether we are rich or poor, are often due to a sense of insecurity. Anxiety is often the driver for some of these kind of unholy actions that we both commit and feel ourselves being the subjects of. We know that anxiety can be addressed by this mysterious kingdom reversal of fun, play, and laughter. And I want to suggest that before we ever amble down the route of the big society, we are actually caught up in some kind of therapeutic activity where we learn to celebrate and play together. And that's partly why I think that Greenbelt intuitively is one of the most wholesome, healing and advanced expressions of the big society. I'll answer my question, even if you won't.
There are a number of things I want to say. First, I agree we should be concerned about anxiety and its destructive effects. We looked at mental illness in relation to inequality in different societies using standardized measures. Anxiety is the form of mental illness that increases most sensitively to inequality, and its worries about status competition, status insecurities, fears are neurosis about how we're seen and judged by each other that becomes increased with more inequality. Morris talked about three aspects of inequality: power, material, and what he called relational inequality. The importance of inequality is that those three things always or almost always go together. And to understand their power over us, you have to understand our evolved sensitivity to these things. And see that in animals, when you get a strong ranking system, dominance is about power, usually physical power of the strongest animal. It is about power of privileged access to material resources. The strong eat first. Status, or what I think Morris calls relational inequality, is about recognition that that animal is dominant and you have to keep out of its way and so on. And they go together again and again and again, not by chance. On the issue of Ed mentioning that he didn't replicate some of our stuff when looking at inequalities, he said to me earlier, we had actually told him he wouldn't be able to before he started that, because we did a review of 168 research projects in peer-reviewed journals looking at inequality and health in lots of different settings, sometimes in small neighborhoods, sometimes cities, sometimes whole societies. The evidence is clearest in the big, in the studies where you look at whole societies, inequality in the whole of a nation. It's weakest when you look at local neighborhoods, because of course health isn't poor. Outcomes aren't bad in a local neighborhood that is very deprived because of the inequality within it. It's bad because that poor community is deprived in relation to the rest of society. When we're talking about the damaging effects of inequality, what we are actually looking at are the effects of class position. And inequality affects whether our society is a steep status hierarchy like that or a much shallower one like that. And to understand the effects of inequality, whether it's looking at violence or teenage pregnancies or any of the other things that go so closely with it, what we need to understand are exactly the same things as we look at with social status. How do these things to do with social status imprint themselves on us throughout life? Inequality increases that sort of differentiation and the power of those processes. We've had several bits of comment on the size of community and what kind of community and so on. We have largely lost community in terms of our local residential neighborhoods, though I was glad to see many people here do know, at least have some friends somewhere on their streets. But that is where we have predominantly lost community. Where we have most to do with each other is at work. But it's at work where we are most divided by status. It's where wealth is not only created, but is the inequalities in wealth, in incomes and so on, are first created, and where we are divided between order givers and order takers, line managers, all that kind of stuff. People say about employee buyouts, and I was going to do some research on comparing 10 employee-owned companies with 10 others, and I visited several when preparing that project. I didn't get money for it, but people said that employee buyouts turn a company from being a piece of property into a community. And indeed, all those kinds of organization, more democratic organizations, whether we're talking about mutuals, cooperatives, friendly societies, or employee-owned companies, they all have smaller income differences within them. And that's how we should be creating communities. It's again where power, status, and so on all go together. And it's there we can be effective in changing the kind of world we live in by making our workplaces more democratic.
Thank you. Morris, I'm going to give you a chance for a quick comeback before we take it back out to the floor again for some final comments and questions.
Yeah, so a few points just to respond directly to the questions. First of all, I would say that in terms of the Northeast and in terms of Stoke, two areas I know quite well. I think that they're the most neglected areas. Those two have been almost entirely neglected, and that's where you see these three things completely coming together. Now, in Stoke, on Trent, it's got the most depleted civic culture that I've ever seen. Basically, we went there to see if it was possible to organise. People don't turn up to church, there's no effective unions. Basically, the only places we could think were the football club and the pubs, were the only two institutions that were in any way popular and people spoke and generated energy. So it's once again to reiterate that the three things go together, the relational poverty, there's no leadership. I mean, what you're talking about is no internal leadership from within the community that can address the issue. So that's why this whole thing about organising and leadership development is absolutely a fundamental issue in Stoke. And I also think that in terms of Newcastle, it's another one where there's been a very passive relationship between the people and local government and the state, and that's shown in the representation. So huge work to be doing there. Just a very brief point about the language, the big society and the language, is that it's right. So if you think about, and that's linked to David's point about Christian democracy, what we haven't got is in work, is we've got an entirely instrumentalized conception of work. So if you start thinking about vocation, which is a deeply Christian concept in terms of how you do your work, if you start talking about virtue in terms of that, then you can be counter what they call in horrible Marxist language, Christianity can become counter-hegemonic to the domination of this language. But it's got to happen from you. I mean, it's got to happen from you. There's got to be a democratic common good politics that expresses this. And so the awful thing with the big society, which we haven't mentioned, is that it pointed to the excessive statism, administration, managerialism of labor, and there was silence. I mean, there was a void to be filled. Now, this relates to the Christian democratic point. If you look at the three organizing concepts in Christian democracy, subsidiarity, solidarity.
Morris, can you just, sorry, a couple of people.
Yeah. Subsidiarity, solidarity, and it's been lots of years since I've done stand-up. Yeah. Subsidiarity, solidarity, and status. Then that is precisely where that's the move we've got to make. But subsidiarity would be about relationships, responsibility, and reciprocity at the appropriate level moving forward. This is a genuinely populist agenda. All I wish to say is there's a huge common ground there between, I think, the Labour movement and Christian democratic movements. And if you look at the German model, where it's not worker ownership, it's the representation of interests in the governance of the firm. So it's worker representation and it's owner representation and it's state representation. The problem with the mutualization model, it's just another single interest group. It's the balance of interests and the negotiation of the common good that really calls me into that. And that's the end of it. I think Richard is right. The one site where there's still a sense of going work is the site of the maximal humiliation of people. Fall back into my arms, I'll catch you, I promise. And they don't. And so what there is just people who don't know what they're doing telling people who do. And this is what happened in Stoke, and this is what happened in the shipyards in the northeast. Financial managers closed down substantive businesses in order to maximise profits, and it's really deeply scandalous and has left people bereft, entirely bereft in their lives. So I think that this is now we can start to think about to improve on the big society. We've got to definitely challenge market power, but we've also got to challenge state power. That's the hard side, through these concepts of vocation, through these ideas of virtue, through these ideas of subsidiarity, and it's pretty urgent, I would say. I mean, you know, I think we should get on with it, really.
Thank you. We've got a couple more opportunities for comments. I know we're slightly overrunning. We've got permission to go on for 15 more minutes till 1:45. So if you've got a comment, if you like the comment, let's see a little bit of participation. Gentleman there.
Okay, my name is Martin Kimber, and I'm a recently redundant local authority youth worker, and there are hundreds, if not thousands, of youth workers who've been made redundant in the last year and a half. I have observed at least one former Labour minister in the audience this evening, and I just hope that this person seems young enough to have a career ahead of him still in 3 or 4 years' time. I just hope that he is picking up much of what's been said today, because I think it's only a change of government that we've got any hope of redressing all the ills that we have so easily identified for the future.
I'm also a youth worker. I've just taken severance from a local authority from, but that's because the town that I come from, they've completely wiped out the youth service, and I said I couldn't stand there and ignore that. I have to do something about it. So I'm currently setting up a new project, but obviously that means I'm working for nothing at the moment. I'm just working on my severance pay, which eventually I'll run out of. And I'm very aware that this big emphasis on volunteering could turn into slave labour. I'm very aware of that, because you'll end up working more and more hours for absolutely zero. People can't live on that. You know, it's not going to work. It just can't work, you know. So I just wanted to let you know that. So, okay.
Hi, my name's Gordon. I've just taken involuntary redundancy from an English regional development agency. I've just been reflecting on what I've been hearing. I've seen some interesting things in the last few years working in English region development stuff. I can see why big society could look attractive to the conservative homelands. I've visited some projects there. It's lovely. You know, people with two incomes, you know, doing arts-based things, working with people with disabilities all in their neighbourhoods. And I can see why Conservative MPs that only ever see that will think it will work. I live in not-so-inner city Sheffield, where, you know, public services, doesn't matter who's delivering them, are being, you know, collapsing in front of us. And I'm worried how we're going to build a rapport with what appears to be a conservative-dominated South that may hold the balance of power for years to come. Years to come.
Thank you.
Hi, my name's Andy. I'm not going to tell a personal story, although I am redundant myself in a few months. The big society, let's go back to that. It's either a con trick or it's a great opportunity. Now, in my view, Cameron's been very, very clever in the sense that it is a contract. He's not defined it, just like Prescott and Blair didn't define best value. He's letting the market define what big society is, and that's partly what we're doing here tonight. He's very clever in doing that. It's a contract. I think it's a huge opportunity, potentially, for the third sector, and that includes churches, in my view. What it definitely is not, Ed, is a brand.
Thank you. Over here.
Peter from Somerset, recently retired. The point I wanted to make was that I get the sense, I have a vision of David Cameron wandering off to the loo one day thinking that he wants a decent soundbite. And he insults us by ignoring everything that we've been doing in our local communities for no money at all, and says, I've got this great idea. He hasn't thought it through. He hasn't got a great idea. So he appoints a minister to look into it. Now, my understanding is that minister has got no idea what the big society is either. And what is then really worrying me is here we are a year or so on, and I don't see what I think should be a major national dialogue to work out what we think this big society should be. And I am worried that from a political point of view, he has reached the stage where he actually needs a quick answer, solution, and some progress. And we actually need a good few years of thinking about what we're trying to do.
I'm going to, thank you for that comment. I'm going to bring it back to the panel now. I'm going to ask you for your closing remarks, and I'm going to draw what's been a very productive session to an end, and I'm being told to be very quick. So, yeah, sure.
I'm ready.
Go.
Two things, both probably will open up the debate rather than be a conclusion.
It's fine.
One thing is that as a species, we tend to overpromise. And so Cameron will overpromise in relation to the big society, but likewise we as churches will overpromise. So I think we ought to be a bit grown up about this habitual performance of overpromising around any idea. Great for motivation, but if we then start blaming because we don't deliver all that's promised, then I think there's something that's not quite grown up about it. But I want to add a comment about the big society and the way it may manifest itself, because we've not commented that it's probably a gendered issue in that it affects women differently than men. So my final comment is, the cocks do all the crowing, but the hen delivers the goods.
Follow that if you can.
I'm not going to even try to follow that, although I'm sure Anne is absolutely right, especially because my surname is Cox. But two final comments from me. Firstly, I come from a left position which is deeply concerned about the big society, but I do encourage you to engage with the conservative rhetoric and philosophy around it. I would particularly encourage you to read Jesse Norman on big society, because there is a serious and substantive and deep discussion that's going on the right, which is challenging neoliberal economics, which I think actually those of us on the left need to almost get behind in order to move the whole agenda forward. So I'd say, don't just dismiss it, please. The second thing I'd say is that we can have these great debates, and we are having these great debates, but as a policy wonk, I get so frustrated that we can be very clever, we can be very articulate in philosophical terms, we can be very critical in the way in which we exercise these debates. But ultimately, things are played out through policies. Now, I'm not saying that the big discussions aren't fundamentally important, and that's why I come to Greenbelt, and that's why I love them. But actually, there are a bunch of policies that are being delivered right now. Community organisers policy, community first fund in deprived neighbourhoods, and others. And we need to critique and engage with those policies. And I really urge you, if you can go away from here with a great policy idea for the next 18 months, 2 years, and you want to email it to me, I will try and weave it into an IPPR report, because we do have a huge opportunity as IPPR, both with the current government, who are now asking precisely the questions that some of you were saying, how are we now going to shape this programme, and also with a potential Labour government, who I think at the moment are a big open goal for good policy ideas.
Don't clap, because we've got to save time, because I'm getting into trouble. Richard, you've got the microphone. Do you have a closing comment?
I think I have rather little to say.
Less can be more.
I think in general, although services are very important in picking up the pieces, that's what they are doing. You know, whether it's health services or whether it's police or whether it's educational psychology or drug rehabilitation, when on the occasions any of these services manage to put someone right, we know that other people are getting into these problems, whether it's heart disease or drugs or violence or whatever, or teenage births. These problems are constantly recreated. Services are not the answer. We need them desperately to pick up the pieces, but we've got to deal with the inequality that creates it. And yeah. I think almost that this is beyond a matter of argument. The data is absolutely clear. 50 studies showing that health is violence is worse in more unequal studies, more unequal societies. About 200 looking at health and inequality. And you see it so clearly with trust and other things as well, the damage of inequality. And what's going to happen is inequality will probably increase. We will need more services because we will generate more of those problems. We'll have less money to deal with it, and so less even of picking up the pieces.
I have to be rude. Maurice, very fast. Or very brief, one or the other.
Yeah, I'll be very fast and brief. Two concluding thoughts. Really, the first and overwhelming one being here is this, that there is, somebody mentioned before, there is a lack of trust in political elites, in the institutions. there is a rage, there is massive mental illness and all these things. And below the surface, it could be very... These could be great times, these could be very bad times. And what I'm absolutely convinced of, with the same intensity that Richard is convinced of his data, is that the Christian contribution to the new politics is going to be definitive and extremely, extremely important. And that I just really urge you to engage with love in your heart with the politics of the common good.
Three things. It might be four, but three. One, thank you very much for coming and for participating and contributing so much from yourself on the floor. Two, on behalf of everyone in the audience, let me thank everyone who's participated here and given us the intellectual leadership. Thank you very much for that. Third thing, tomorrow, 2 o'clock, there's going to be a session in the kitchen which will give those of you who are involved in community initiatives and projects an opportunity to share and to talk about that. It's really a continuation of this conversation, and there'll be special guests participating in that as well. And the fourth thing was really, as I was listening to this conversation, I couldn't help fast-forwarding to next year and thinking and wondering about what this conversation will be next year and whether we have, as a community of people, to pick up Anne's point, people from Greenbelt who have exceptional... exceptional sort of contribution to make, what that contribution has been as Greenbelters, as members of our local communities, as members of our church. So I look forward to continuing this conversation and hope that Greenbelt will give us the opportunity to do that.